point made in this long lecture is the centrality of beauty.
The foreign woman.
Well, what would be the basis for withstanding a foreign woman?
I don't know. The word, as he said, Dr. Nass said in his opening remark, was Hassan in the languages of the Middle East combines the good, the beautiful, and the perfect. And so if you see the name Hassan, it is always referring to this deepest quality inside of a human being. And his remark is that it is the universal language that God has given to the earth and has implanted inside of us. So what we carry together, what we are beginning to construct together, is something having to do with the language of beauty. I would like to set the stage for our gathering this weekend by saying that given the circumstances that I think we're living in, this may be the most consequential gathering that we've had to date. Just to remind ourselves, we are a unique band of contemplatives. We're a unique band of wisdom seekers, not always understood. We find strength in one another's journeys. So your journey strengthens mine. And we're in association with one another, in this band of association, to create an experiment in modern spirituality. Our experiment is to practice interiorized monasticism both inside and outside formal institutions. So that's an intention that we've set ourselves, to practice this monastic form of interiorized monasticism, both inside and outside. But we're here not to simply engage ourselves. Our true monastic vocation is to the outer world. We're to bring this interior space and the truth of perennial wisdom, Sophia Perennis, especially for many of us, as it has been expressed out through the wisdom stream of Yeshua, to bring that perennial wisdom stream into the outer world, into the exoteric world, by holding its beauty inside of us. So the relationship between beauty inside of us and what we extend to the world outside of us is a big experiment. We're a gathering of experimenters. And I want to put three basic premises on the table, so to speak, tonight as we attempt to do this. We are attempting this experiment in a world of extraordinary chaos. No one has to remind us of that, except it's really important to keep that before us. This is not an easy experiment to be making in this particular kind of world. The world that we inherit appears to be spiraling into greater and greater exponential chaos, unstoppable. There appears to be no end in sight. In almost every direction we look, in any field that you can imagine, it seems that this disintegration, this chaotic disintegration, is at work. It's the prevailing condition. I woke up this morning, as I often do, early, and I looked through some of the news feeds that was coming to my iPad. And the first three things I saw, I usually look at New York Times, just sort of a summary of New York Times, when I'm wanting to know what's going on outside of my bedroom in the world, in the chaotic world. And the first thing I saw was this. This was headlined in New York Times today. The book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Apocalypse Is Now. That was New York Times. Today. And then I turned, usually the second thing that gets my my email is Washington Post, just a kind of summary of Washington Post. And here it was. The free world is leaderless, and these are the pretenders. So you have Justin Trudeau, you have Angela Merkel, you have Macron in France, and you have Theresa May. Meaning they're attempting in this chaotic world to bring order out of the chaos, but it looks like they're unable to do it. And then the third thing was looking at a summary of the news that Google News has. One of the entries of Google News this morning was, it's winter time in Iceland, it is raining, and the ice is melting. It's winter time. It's raining, and the ice is melting. Three things, just boom, boom, boom. And I knew as I was preparing for this evening that I wanted to put that on the table because that's the environments, that's the prevailing condition in which we're working. Is it true that the apocalypse is now? Is it true that the world we live in, that we've been counting on to have strength, is in fact leaderless? And is it true that the earth itself is collapsing? You don't have to look very far anywhere to see that these tensions exist in almost every area, every level. And we see that the sacred traditions themselves that we have counted on often to bring stability are in a state of collapse or disintegration. I was talking with Michael, who's now serving in a Methodist, large Methodist community in Houston. They've just gone through a horrendous weekend. They're not sure that they can survive, at least in the way that they have been for the last 100 years. The natural order itself that we depend on as human beings is in this state of decay and collapse, and it's almost unthinkable what's happening in those parts of the world that are basically out of our purview. The oceans themselves are collapsing. Species decline in the oceans are precipitous. The insect population on the earth is down by a third, maybe a half. That's the canary in the coal mine. And they're just bugs. You know, what do we care about the bugs? Well, they're the canaries in the coal mine. There's no denying these things, and yet we live in a culture of denial. So that's part of the whole issue of the ones we serve. The humanity that we serve is in a deep state of denial and in need of waking up, and that awakening will occur, but the question is, will it be too late? It's in the vested interest of the powers of the world to deny as long as possible, because they have a stake in keeping the game going as it has been going. So, regardless of how long this lasts as a kind of facade that everything is going to maintain itself, it maintains until the end, and then it stops. Much like it did for folks up in Michigan this winter when the vortex came. And suddenly everything stopped. Much like it does on the Gulf Coast when a hurricane comes through. And it hit Harvey when it hit Houston. I heard my youngest son's dad, I cannot imagine what has happened. This is beyond my imagining, and I'm afraid for my family. Much like will happen when someone hits the button in the cyber war of the internet and that collapses. Another truth about this chaos is that we live in what the book of Revelation calls the belly of the beast. And this amazing image, being in the beast, or being in the belly of the beast, which has been around for a long time, part of the prophetic tropes of our tradition, is in truth not an external ideology. The great Antichrist out there. It's brilliantly portrayed in the book of Revelation that the beast is us. Or even more specifically, not us as a human species, although we are undeniably bringing this demise to the planet, but us controlled collectively by the conscious ego. That's the beast. We're all living in it. This collective beast that inhabits the consciousness of humanity is what is devouring our planet. And we're all a part of it. There's not one of us, no civilization, regardless of time, space, or culture, that is exempt from the power of the beast. It's endemic. It is us. It's systemic. It's in the nature of things. It's the sad part of our own reality. We all live in this beast. Though slowly, slowly, humans begin to wake up and realize, yes, they're in it, but they need not be of it. And so they begin to stand out of the belly of the beast. I have an article that I'm going to send you. It arrived probably 4 days ago. A wonderful article on this very realization, this awakening, about what this systemic consciousness of humanity is doing to us and how it is holding us. I'm going to send it to you as a email, and I'll send it to you tonight, but I wanted to preface it with this talk that we're having this evening. So these are the conditions, and we know them, and it is in a certain way frightening. And yet in another way, it is the most challenging environment that monks could ever live in. In the Abrahamic traditions, there's been an intuition about all of this. You just can't deny that. In the biblical world, in the world of early Judaism, the prophetic tradition, later Christianity, and then on into Islam, there's been the sense that human history is moving towards some climactic end or change as a result of the chaos. The chaos caused by the beast who is us, the beast who is our own egoic nature and control of the world. The active voice of transcendence has been speaking. It's been speaking news across the ages, news of the cosmos. Pay attention. Pay attention to what is, as we say in Texas, fixing to come upon us. The future has been speaking into the present moment. That's called realized eschatology. The future speaking. The voice across the ages has been speaking. And it began in earnest with the Axial Age, approximately 500 years before the advent of Jesus, when the vertical axis opened up across the planet, and humankind began to see and began to perceive, at least a certain segment of humankind began to see from another perspective. I came across, I don't think I invented this, I'm sure I didn't, but it made immediate sense to me, that the prophetic tradition is something like this. And I mentioned it weekend before last, I'm in San Marcos, that this makes sense, that once the axial vertical axis is established and it's possible for humankind to transcend and to see from a different perspective. perspective. It's like when we gather on the street in hometown for the parade, and you're on the horizontal plane. You're right there on street level. And the parade is coming. You begin to hear, oh, the parade is coming, the parade is coming. And so what is in the future? It's coming. They're telling us the parade is coming, the parade is coming. The first float comes by, there it is. There's the float. And then there comes the band. And they're playing, and they've got drummers, and they've got, you know, girls dancing. Oh, it's just amazing. And then there comes the mayor and his limousine, and it's going to be an hour-long parade, and you just see one thing and another, and oh, yeah, 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 that float. That was four floats ago, and there's that band. Where are they from? It's faded into the past, right? And right before me is the next group. They're the FFA, and they're bringing their cows, and, you know, showing off everything. And oh, this is the kids doing their thing. And now I'm into the FFA, and I'm enjoying that. Off they go. And I can hear bands in the future. Just little sounds of the bands in the future. They're coming down the road. And let's imagine, prophetically, that for some reason a hot air balloon arrives and invites us to step into it. And the hot air balloon ascends. Up goes the vertical axis. And suddenly what was past
is present.
And present and future is totally the same. There is no past, there is no present, there is no future, it is all now. The whole parade lays before you. That's the prophetic vision. That is the news, and you're to have the microphone. Hey, all of you all down there, I'll tell you what's coming up. How do you know? Oh, I can see. So, this is, in a certain sense, the voice or the perspective of prophecy that has been speaking about the totality of the human condition and allowing us to have some sense of its sweep and its end. This, I think, is in fact the perspective of Sophia Perennis. When her voice speaks, when the voice of prophecy speaks, it's imperative that we keep in mind that that consciousness is not at the street level. The little segment that I'm taking in at the moment, no matter what it is, it's from this transcendent perspective. So that is the wisdom that is given to us to be able to discern what might be coming down the pipe, but from another perspective. From a perspective that takes in the whole. So when the prophetic voice speaks to us, it's speaking out of both the end and the beginning and the middle. And what the point of the whole parade is. There's another precept that we have to put on the table tonight. The chaos, the prophetic vision, that has been speaking about where history may be going. And the third premise is this, that from the perspective of wisdom, universal wisdom, traditional wisdom, Sophia Perennis, there is the precept that mysteriously you are on the earth at this shattering time, at this breathtaking moment, not by chance. That is one of the teachings of perennial wisdom. You are here, if you're here, and you are, then you've been sent here, or you volunteered to come at this moment. Now, again, that's another perspective, higher perspective. It's not a street-level perspective. You come into this world at perhaps the end of the parade, perhaps as the world collapses into greater and greater chaos. At the very moment when it's possible that there will be a catalytic shift. So one of the perceptions that is a modern perception about chaos and chaos theory is that as the chaos increases, the intensity and the energy of the chaos, which is disconcerting to say the least, it sets up the condition for the possibility of either breakdown at the tipping point or breakthrough. And we don't know which. But there's something always called the butterfly effect. That the tiniest little movements can have an outsized effect at the beginning of any movement inside the chaos. It can have a much larger effect than could be imagined if things were just stable or there was basically stasis involved in the way the world was moving. It's not static, it's chaotic. And that's when the butterfly effect works. And that's when to be catalytic is the most critical. We often pay attention to big events, but little events, the flapping of the wing of a butterfly, as it's told in chaos theory, can have an outside effect, outsized effect. So we're here to bring about a catalytic change. And as we were traveling, Allison and Susan, I picked them up at the airport, we traveled down through the beautiful Texas countryside. It looked pretty good. But we were talking about what are the signs of breakthrough when we're surrounded with breakdown. It's so, when you're in the midst of chaos, it's so easy to pay attention to breakdown because that's the most threatening. We're threatened by breakdown. And there's a lot of signs of breakdown. We could spend all evening going through the signs of breakdown. Just mentioned a few. But what are the signs of breakthrough? There are a lot of them. There's as many indicators that things are moving towards another level of order as that we will move into total collapse and disorder. I'm not predicting. But our visionary tradition says, oh, and by the way, there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And it will be because there, as Dr. Ness said, there are men and women of beauty who held beauty in their soul, who ministered from that particular place of beauty. We're meant to be catalytic because we've been awakened by the voice of wisdom herself to see the whole picture, or as much of it as we can stand. It's hard to stand it because the intensity is so great. If technology is not the entire answer, then the infusion of wisdom completes it. I'm not dismissing technological change. I hope there are some technologies out there that will break log jams. I've got my fingers crossed that that's possible. But even when there's breakthroughs technologically, the tendency of human beings who are held by the beast is to use it for evil ends. And it's only wisdom that can break that tendency. So, what is a wisdom approach that this, our summit of summits annually, is to be about? We're here to share with one another, to share our sense of things, to experiment and share our experiments. Our work as an order of perennial wisdom, Sophia Perennis, is about her beauty, her energy, her stern mothering commands. Yeah, she's mother. children. Her care of her children. Her care of what happens to her children. We are her children, and we are her spokespersons. And we are now listening in a very, very intense way. I think that's a key. We're starting to listen to, if I can present it that way, mother's voice.
Same.
Mother's voice. And to speak as she presents herself to us as both news of the cosmos, medicine for its healing, and wisdom which will guide it into its future. So, sort of that higher perspective, news from the cosmos, that big picture prophetic tradition. I don't know what I'm doing to this, but
it's the battery, I think.
It's the battery. Okay. We'll stop. But the dictum, the ancient dictum that she spoke, at least in one of the traditions, that we are to love the true and the beautiful and the good. That is our mission. To love the true, the beautiful, and the good. Four words. Love, truth, beauty. That's her dictum. And their opposites are hatred, which leads to falsehood, which leads to ugliness, which leads to evil. So the energy that she gives is to create inside of us this love for what is true, what is beautiful, and what is good. The particular Christian approach that is shared across the Abrahamic faiths is anastasis, which means the call to the resurrection principle, which is the word to stand up, to awaken from sleep, then to stand up and to begin our own journey along the vertical axis, closer and closer to where we can see, where we can hear, and where we can act from that particular position. This is the shared trope of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We share this particular principle, standing up out of the cosmos. So the goal of our work, the deep goal of our work is that it will be sapiential and not shallow. It will be not distracted. It will be focused. Work that is focused, first of all, has to change us. It has to change our inner being. And again, the reason that the divine has brought us into the world as a work of the divine art is to create a beautiful soul. And a beautiful soul was actually created in chaos. Sort of like the pressure of earth pressure that creates precious stones. It takes that. And the qualities that are built into a beautiful soul are its ability to see beyond its own ego, its ability to act with the qualities of heaven or with virtue, and the ability to take that energy and freely give it in freedom to the world around us. So the inner work balanced with the outer work that makes a difference in the world, that provides sustenance, that provides compassion, that provides learning, that provides empowerment. See, I think, not well understood, but the best thing that we do is to empower others on their journey. We give them, we donate energy out of what is being implanted in our own hearts and in our own beings. So we begin to work through a time when this principle of anastasis is being raised up in a world in which there is darkness and confusion. And that is the work of a monk, which means, the word monk is interesting because it refers back to a tradition in which listening is so critical. Monks took time to listen. They took time to reflect. They didn't act precipitously. They didn't act out of distraction or out of egoic need. They acted out of a deep sense of listening. This deep cardinal listening at the level of the heart. And then followed by art and skill that was skillful, beautiful, attending to the world as beautifully as they knew how to do. So we are, I'll run through the list, I'll come back to it. We are guides, we are mentors, we are gardeners, we are midwives. We work as an emergency care unit in a triage way. We are crisis caregivers. We are attending to those who are dying, and we are burying with dignity that which is dead. This is the beautiful work of monks in the world. So, first of all, feeding ourselves, and I will be talking about that through the weekend. We get totally distracted when our own soul is not being fed by truth and goodness and beauty. We just die inside. And in particular, when the world is the way it is, we need that the most. That's what makes us strong enough and changes the very nature, the core of our own being, and lifts us above the beast, to stand up out of the beast that is ourselves. So this deep feeding and this deep listening and this work of monastic interiority is what we're first called to. And then we turn, and with that inside of us, we listen tenderly to this world that's in chaos and in pain. Tenderly. Allowing there to be some kind of transmission. And that transmission is the work that has been given to us out of the tradition of contemplative wisdom. To create a soul, the painting of a soul, that is something like that. That we are in the artistry of our own creation, and we are in the work of artistry, creating beautiful souls. This is a tender work. It's something that requires skill. It requires an inner freedom. And I want you to just keep that image in mind, because we're in the process of being filled in. That the work of art is in progress. We're not complete. And yet we get to participate in the artistry of the divine hand as the divine hand fills in ourselves. I'm going to have to turn off my viper. Yeah, it typically does. Because they're just starting to wake up. So, this work is both the creation of beauty inside and outside. And it is like when we attend with our hearts to any particular thing. One image that is beautiful is, those of you that love to garden, it's a slow work. It's not something that happens overnight. It's something that you love, you devote yourself to, and you create something of beauty in the earth and out of the earth, and it takes weeks and days and months, and sometimes to get a really good garden with good soil, it takes years. And then the idea of the nurturing and the raising up, and then the reaping, and then the creation of something good out of that that's being done. So this tending in the soil of the earth, and this creative work of art. So what does it mean when we have that? It means that we have to show up in these conditions, in this world where this humus is available to us, where this canvas is available to us, where this artistry can begin to go on. We have to show up, we have to be present, we have to be stable enough to take strategic action. So that means inner stability. That's why to pair chaos with stability is absolutely essential. That's why we're gathered. How do you maintain stability in chaos? And if you've ever been in an emergency room and where there is a whole lot of energy going on and you can't be like your partner. So you have different kinds of environments. You have to take strategic action. You have to make decisions in a split second in that kind of environment. You have to bark commands in an emergency room. And I think sometimes wisdom's voice is like that. To save the life of something, you have to act in that strategic way. You can't get caught up in your own emotional stuff. You have to set that aside. Yeah, I've got all these feelings. I've got all this fear. I've got all this welling up inside of me. You have to set it aside. It's being dispassionate in that kind of environment. And you don't really have a choice when you're acting in that kind of environment. You have to act in that particular way. You have to be brave, smart, alert, prophetic, caring. But then comes the moment of being gentle and being a listening ear to those who are in need. I want to show you some of our ancestors. And I would like to talk to you about this particular event, because this is not unlike what happened in the Middle East about 850-900 years ago. This is the time of the Mongol invasion. And the Mongol invasion was apocalyptic. There was no doubt about its apocalyptic nature. The Muslim world and the world of the Middle East, the world of China, Korea, Japan, North India, entire Middle East, into Europe, was swept and touched by this Mongol invasion. And Rumi was the families of Rumi, and Rumi himself came out of, I can't put my finger on it so you can see it. You can see Samarkand up there?
Yes.
He lived in that area. That's where he was born, in that area, Samarkand. And let's see, maybe this is a better map. Yeah, you can see it a little bit easier. So you have Bukhara, Samarkand, Kashgar, Merv, and Tus, Neshapur. All of that is in Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, that area of the world at this particular time. And that was Old Persia. That was part of Old Persia. So the Mongols, the pressure of the Mongols came down, and we don't, you know, it's just a little sketch in our minds about how horrendous that was. But it was truly the upending of their world. And they were in, they had to take strategic action. And millions of people perished at the hands of the Mongols as it swept across the Middle East. And that's what came out of it. That was what was created out of the pressure of the Mongols. They began to dance. The beauty of Rumi's poetry came out of the Mongol invasion. The whirling dervishes came out of the Mongol invasion. Beauty triumphed over that unimaginable ugliness. Almost beyond belief. So, what happened out as a result of that was this flourishing of spirituality, of wisdom, and of beauty. And we read it today. And they began to turn, and they began to dance. And the voice of wisdom poured out through the poets of that particular period and affected the world as the Mongols marched across that part of the planet and devastated it. And what's so interesting about the Mongol invasion, if you read its history and you read about Genghis Khan and the sons and the armies that followed and the governments that rose out of it, Islam resisted. The first phase of Islam certainly tried to resist, but they were unable to do it. They couldn't resist the Mongols. And the Mongols took down every institution that Islam had loved and valued. And it did the same thing in China, it did the same thing in Korea, it went all across the ocean to Japan. Japan was able, because of the ocean, to defend itself to some degree, but it did affect Japan. It went all the way into Russia, went all the way into Europe, and deeply, deeply affected the earth. But it was the voice of wisdom that began to speak out of this and to treat, it's so interesting, the Mongols in such a way that they converted to Islam. And that's not generally understood, that one of the ways that this tradition was able to overcome the energy and the power of the Mongols was, in fact, to show a kind of wisdom and to show a kind of compassion that actually the Mongols succumbed to the Islamic world. And eventually, and they are all today, all the Mongols, essentially, are Muslim. There's a few Buddhist Mongol people up in Mongolia, but their populations are small. When the majority of the Mongol populations had spread across that part of the world, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, northern Iran, I lived when we were in Iran among those people. It's very clear they were all there. They were all Muslim. They were all integrated. And it was because of this. Interesting. We forget that. We don't realize. And this turning was not just beautiful dancing, it was turning towards the heart. And that's what Rumi taught his students in Turkey. Another thing that we have experienced is the collapse of the Roman Empire. And if you read any of the stories of the collapse of the Roman Empire, that was an apocalyptic moment. It was shocking to Europe, Central Europe, the Mediterranean. It absolutely sent chills through the civilization of the world. And brought it to its knees. And the monks began to pray, and they began to establish enclaves of wisdom, islands of stability in a chaotic world. So there's parallels between these various moments of apocalyptic chaos and ruin when those who are listening begin to act out of compassion, they begin to act strategically, they begin to act out of their own inner beauty, they begin to minister not in the belly of the beast, but standing up out of it. As I was thinking about all of this, and I had spent a lot of time in my own work when I was in Iran, trying to understand Iranian culture and why Iran was what it was, why its language was the way it was, why Islamic culture, how it changed, what the Mongols did. So I could really grasp that sweep of history. So I knew that I wanted to remind us that that which we love and treasure out of that moment comes because of that and this, and that which we love and are attempting to do now comes out of the monastic tradition that began to establish islands of stability where there could be a possibility of renewal, out of which would come a possibility of renewal of Europe. So as I was reflecting on this for this work that we're doing, I was talking to Anne, and Anne isn't with us this weekend, unfortunately. She had to make a bishop of them. And but at any rate, she sends her love. But we were talking back and forth about this, and she said, "Lynn, please remind people that we have in our age heroes." Amazing energy of love and care and wisdom. please remind people of him.
I'm sorry, Lynn, I can't hear what his last name is.
Bernie Glassman. Remind me of the book that is so...
Bearing Witness.
Yeah, wonderful text. There is a wisdom practitioner, a monastic, on the streets, doing this work. So we have the fall of Rome, we have the Mongol invasion, but we have the collapse and chaos in our own world. Please remind people of Desmond Tutu, a hero in our own day, another whirling dervish, for goodness sakes, who acted with other leaders across the planet, Dalai Lama and New York best friends, and still acting in concert with one another. And then she reminded me, and she was actually reading of this theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a saint of World War II when everything was collapsing. And he took what he considered to be strategic action. It might not have been what you would do, but he felt he had to stop evil with his own body, his own being. And he paid the price for it. But one of the great saints of our era, who lived in the midst of the Nazi world, when it was bearing down on the world. These are the heroes of our day, who proclaimed a wisdom that was not their own, which came from another source, which came from a heart of beauty and love and compassion, generosity and vision and prophetic vision. These are our heroes. These are the ones and just said, I won't be able to be there, but please remind the community of these, our heroes. And the reason that they were able to act with this kind of beauty and this kind of strategic action, whatever it was that they were called to do in the midst of the world that they were in, was because they were practicing their own inner contemplative vision. They were coming out of it. They were working out of it. They were, what was arriving in the world was from a higher source. They were not making it up. They were receiving barks from the emergency room of heaven. Do this, do that. So what did we learn out of all of this? We learned that there could be resistance, but nonviolent. There could be self-sacrifice for the common good. There could be the establishment of islands of stability and order in the middle of a world that was absolutely falling apart, where human beings could find their feet again, find their feet in order to stand up. And they did that because they were willing to lay aside their own personal agenda on behalf of the world, for the good of the world. They acted like a whole community. And the forces both east and west across these various traditions were strong when the moment came. So inner stability gave rise to outer action, which gave rise to the creation of possibility of the common good. This was wisdom coming from another source. This was, we might give it, contemplative theosophy, meaning the knowledge of wisdom that comes from a contemplative source. Contemplative theosophy. And the teachings that came out of that were beautiful and powerful and effective. It came out of a form of consciousness that was not defined by the beast of the human ego. It came out of a direct knowledge that came through the heart. And so, as we gather, what we're, not one of us has a complete answer, but we are being shaped by the divine artistry. And it is my realization that this artistry, and now I'm going to use it, in the world that is controlled by this consciousness, in a world in which there is decay, interesting images, it's a good one. You know, it's sort of like that decay that's right in the, you know, at the root of everything.
And it comes with toothpaste.
Yeah, say it again.
Toothpaste.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you for seeing that. Well, we're all going to rush out and get Max some toothpaste. When we're beginning to realize, I was reading again in the last couple of days in Africa, I think it's Benin. I think that's right. That they are, you know, the Africans are trying to exercise and do more to keep themselves healthy. And they're running on their beaches and they're taking in so much pollution as they run. And so it was this, you know, trying to stay healthy in an unhealthy world, chaotic world. So, wisdom from above, fire from below. That's the world we live in. With the help of Allison, we created this image, and she was, I thought she was going to use it, and so I was not going to show it, but I asked her today in the car. She said, I'm not going to show it. I said, okay, then I'm going to use it. So, these are the two forces. And the one on the left we're so familiar with. It's the one that's been on the planet for so long. But the one on the right is the power of wisdom. And if you notice, the left hand is male and the right hand is female. And the left hand is aggression and the right hand is resistance. I should not be telling you this, you should be telling me. But this is the clash that we're in. And we sometimes need an image like this to remind us that where those two meet, there is a tremendous amount of energy. A huge amount of energy. And we're going to feel that energy. And I think as we listen, we're going to hear the voice of Spirit. So, it's my realization, just as I live through the world, that it is, in fact, beauty that will begin to overcome the power on the left-hand side here. That it is the voice that speaks out of heaven that begins to inform us. And I sense it more and more as I listen to you, as I hear when Anne was telling me, Lynn, please say this, please say that. I won't be there, but please say this. I was hearing not just Anne, I was hearing wisdom speaking. And I realized that spiraling energy is inside of us. We are being guided across this chaotic time by her voice. And of course, I wanted to make these as beautiful as I possibly could, because it's my contention that beauty will trump ugliness and evil. Again, this idea that we're walking through time, but we're also walking into eternity. And I've been walking, not as much as I wish I could, with Tom as he's leaving the planet, but I've been spending time with him and as I could, and Ron and Karen have, and others of you have contacted, and it's been a wonderful, the community has gathered around Tom, and Tom is so, so grateful. He's just said, please tell the community how grateful I am, for you all. As he walks out of this world, he's being guided by Spirit, as you can feel it. And we're being guided by Spirit as we follow him. I said, Tom, we're not too far behind you. We're just, you know, a couple blocks down. And we'll be walking down, but we're sensing that gift that time and eternity are giving us to be active in this world. And the dictum of wisdom is love that which is true and good and beautiful. And what you begin to realize is love is pouring through the arteries of the universe. Pouring through. And I don't know if you see what the arteries of this universe are in this image. Anyone want to say what they see?
Look like thorns.
Yeah, they look like thorns.
Looks like what?
Thorns. So the divine energy is coming through the chaos, coming through the thorniness of this world. And there will be resistance. And this image I haven't yet shown to the group that are meeting around our study of the apocalyptic text, but we're doing that right now in San Marcos. But one of the images, one of the tropes of the book of Revelation, is that wisdom stands higher and is crowned above the beast, the dragon. And that wisdom trumps the beast, overcomes the beast. And just a way of imaging it, it says, yes, we're in league with her. That's at the end of the parade. That float's coming up. And in the meantime, and this is a wonderful, and it's an image that is an idea, a wisdom idea, that is being expressed by Rumi and many others that came out of the Mongol world, that we're like bees gathering nectar from the world that we live in. We're gathering and gathering and gathering. And we go out into the world, and we're sending what we have found and what we love and the souls that come into our world, we're sending that heavenward. It's a very interesting idea. Yeshua teaches it in his own parables. He says, you know, what we read here, what we gain here, send it heavenward. So, like bees, we're taking what comes out of our experience of the world, and we're re making it to be food for the cosmos, food for the universe. And it's an amazing idea. It just lifts you right out of the street level view of what's going on to another possibility. And that was, in fact, what all of those heroes did. They made honey, they collected, they sent it heavenward, they changed their world. I never believed, as I was walking through the experience of South Africa, there would be nothing but a blood bag. But it didn't happen. So it was because they had this capacity to do that, to do something beautiful. So all of these images that I'm just showing you now in a kind of series are images in which beauty gives us hope. Beauty triumphs over the chaos. Wisdom speaks out of the darkness. The ultimate view of our transcendent prophetic tradition is that there will be, as a result of the work we've done, a new heaven and a new earth. Just an image. It's incomplete. Doesn't even begin to match what will be. But at least it gives us an idea. Could I be catalytic for such a possibility? And our tradition says, oh yes, you're here. Because you chose to come at this particular time, or you were sent at this particular time. And the whole reason is to be catalytic, to be those who make available, through your own pursuit of love, of the true, the good, and the beautiful. As I was preparing this, one of my monk friends, Mr. Sam, sent me some wonderful things. And Sam, you didn't know this, but I was collecting. Because I had this sense that as I was preparing for tonight, I needed to really pay attention to what was coming in. What was coming into me. Ann spoke, Tom spoke, Allison was speaking, and Sam sent me some of the most beautiful things about the work of the monk that he'd come across. And so I collected, and I want you to have it, and I'm not going to read it. I want you to just use this as a kind of culmination of our thought tonight. That the way we overcome beliefs is precisely the wisdom that is being spoken in this short segment. And they're truly remarkable. And I was grateful for the gift that so many people brought, and some of it was a good portion of this came through Sam's looking and seeing and sending me things, and then other things arrived from my sister and other sources. But I just realized this is being sent to you. I was just merely the collection point, and I thought, I want us to have this, and I want you to take the time to read it, you know, back in a reflective way, and because it really is the answer, not that we're going to control the chaos. I'm not sure we can ever do that. But we can stand up using the resurrection principle out of the beast, and then we can begin to act in a strategic, in a deep way towards the world out of the love of the true, the good, and the beautiful. And that means that some of the issues that living in this chaotic world, living in the consciousness of the egoic beast requires. So, as monastics, we have work to do. And our work is daily, every day, we have the opportunity to work with these issues. Every day, the divine hand is creating, filling in the picture, if I can get back to it. Filling in the picture as we help others in the work of beautiful art. Beginning to create this beautiful soul that is the soul of every human being in potential. Every human being can become a masterwork of the divine. But we get to pick up the brush. We get to apply the colors. We get to act. And that's our privilege in such an environment. So this is just setting the stage, realizing that not one person here alone has any the whole answer. We do it together as a community. We do it because of our love that is coming to us. We do it in the midst of a fearful time when we need to be brave. It's not easy to be brave when we're being confronted in the ways that we are. So I wanted to make that our opening and say I hope that as we have discussion, and we're going to have the opportunity tomorrow after Blake speaks to us, to sit down together in reflection. So carry tonight's work with you for that. We'll combine that with the vision that will be presented to us tomorrow morning. But we're gathering. This is nectar. This is honey. I just sent honey around. And that's being gathered. And this is helping to create beauty, love, and truth, and goodness in a world in which the opposite exists. So I